Okay, good. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Labor Beat Radio program. We broadcast here on Tuesdays, 9 a.m. on www.enlightenradio.org. And, of course, we are player is always available at player.enlightenradio.org. And unless I'm doing something peculiar on the computer it's always on. And this morning's conversation, we're going to be missing Scott Marshall because he has a SOAR meeting this morning, apparently, in which he's supposed to make some big report. So SOAR is the Steel Workers Retirees Organization. I forget what the whole acronym stands for. So we'll miss him this morning, which is a little bit too bad because steel workers have taken a pretty solid position on the topic of interest here today. Dr. John Aldous is our a guest. He's been on some of our programs before occasionally, and but he has a long career and in public service. You know, I'll say it that way as a, and he's very familiar with most of the issues concerned with universal coverage, public coverage, national health care. Medicare for all the different brands that are trying to do something to try and get universal care. And as he worked for, I think, the State Department or U.S. Foreign Service for many years, and of course, the federal workers and veterans and stuff, they tend to have a version of single-payer health care. So anyway, I'm glad that he's here today, and I know I had a conversation with him, and the part that's very pertinent to our program here at Labor Beat is it's been a problem getting what ought to be a fairly easy endorsement for universal health care from the entire labor movement for fairly complicated reasons historically, chief of the being is that it's not a proposal you can negotiate across the table with a corporation. It's something you have to achieve, you know, legislatively, politically, and you know, the trade unions do not recruit people based on their political ideology. They recruit people based on who's working in the plant or in the office or the shop. So the political complexion of the trade unions is not, foregone conclusion. and you do have certain unions where, mostly because of the history of collective bargaining with respect to health coverage, has taken up so much of the what there is to negotiate about. That I would say the industrial unions primarily have. I think they're, most of them are on record supporting one version or another of national health care. But there are others, you know, who, for other reasons. For example, there were many trades locals. I just want to put this up front so we have a context here. There are many trades locals that don't have a single employer. And the people work for different, you know, contracts. All over the place. And so the unions themselves, in order to get health care benefits, would set up their own health and welfare funds, which so that the workers who worked, you know, in the union and doing, whether it was painters or carpenters or glaziers or what, you know, riggers, whatever, would be covered, you know, when they changed, you know, who they were doing the job for. Well, that led to a possibility of the union. See, when the union's fortunes are great, that's fine. But then when it gets not so great and jobs go down, the building that they purchased to, you know, run the insurance operation now also gets to become the union headquarters because they can't afford two. And, you know, one thing leads to another. And pretty soon there's an investment, you know, in this particular fund, or including in whoever's doing the, whoever they're paying to do the, whatever they call it, the failover level of insurance at the top level, catastrophic, I think, coverage. You know, they can't get out of it without closing down the building and losing the union office. I mean, I've seen that's happened. So there's some institutional problems about, you know, transferring people that were on independent plans and independently funded plans that kept the AFL-CIO Executive Council, which is comprised of at least half craft-based historically unions. They haven't taken a position on it. Or they resisted taking it. It was a big effort that Bernie made when he ran for president. He got quite a few votes on the Executive Council, but not enough to endorse. So that's just my introduction. I want to welcome John Aldis to the program. I know he has you know, his own thinking on this and why he's interested in it. So welcome, John, and I hope I didn't... my mother always told me, just, John, please shut up. Would you just please shut up? Okay. Anyway, welcome, John. Open up for us.
Thank you, John. I need to hear these other views of why single-payer healthcare systems might not work in certain groups. And it's important hearing the reasons why the labor unions may not be fully supportive of a single payer system taking over what they're doing in healthcare. I understand that. And I fully don't expect any system that anyone comes along with is going to make everybody happy. But like you said, the thrust of what's trying to get accomplished isn't starting at the down here level. It has to come from Congress. Or state legislators, hopefully Congress, and higher up. And that's kind of where we're focusing on. My own career was, I was joined by the Navy in for 10 years, loved it, and then Department of State for 18 years. And after that, I did about a year at the VA hospital here in Martinsburg. And what I realized after discussions with some of my friends in an organization I work with, that's all single payer. Doctor shows up to the office, takes care of patients, goes home, gets a paycheck. That's it. The patients show up, they're sick and they go to the doctor. The doctor will do some gatekeeper function, as all doctors do. Some doctors like to blame it on the insurance companies as the gatekeeper, but if someone walks in and wants a ridiculous mode of treatment that makes no sense to any clinical group, that doctor says, no, we're not going to do that. Well, we always do that in the military and in the State Department and in the VA. Not as well in the VA as we should, but I mean, still, there is the same gatekeeper function. The patients generally were very, very happy, very happy. If they had a complaint with the care they were getting, they would talk to one of my superiors or the organization more broadly. And there were intelligent people, usually a bunch of healthcare professionals as well, who would say, look, Aldis, you're ridiculous. You should have provided this care for the patient. And they let me know in no uncertain terms. And that happened once or twice in my over 30 years of care. But other times they would tell the patient, no, that's not a reasonable request. This happens in the State Department, in private care all the time, because private care is insurance company driven, and the insurance company does that job for us. The insurance company is the gatekeeper. But the insurance company's main goal is to take care of their stockholders, their bottom line. That's their main goal. There can be no argument of that. That's not the State Department's goal. That's not the military's goal. That's not the U.S. government's goal. So there was a big difference. There is a big difference there. An organization I'm currently involved with is something called the Physicians for National Healthcare Program. This is a bunch of physicians, many, many thousands of physicians, who, like me, feel that a single-payer national healthcare program is important. So that's where I'm coming from. Both a person who did single care for 30, 35 years, and somebody who is now supporting the concept. I don't have any detailed solutions to address this problem. I'll say right up front, I don't. There is a major bill trying to make its way through Congress, which has zero chance of going anywhere, which is pretty good. It's well thought out. It's many, many, many pages long. I honestly can't give you a summary of how that's going to go, but it is considered a Medicare for all bill. That is, it'll provide care. There's a debate in the single-payer folks as to what is intended by the program. There are many people, including people in PNHP, and I've had some pretty brisk arguments with some of them on this point. There are literally people out there who think everybody in America living here should get the same level of care. And that's like saying everybody should drive the same kind of cars and send their kids to the same schools, eat in the same restaurants, same care. That's not going to work. It has never worked. It's never worked in other countries with single-payer systems. That's not going to happen. Ain't going to happen. So I was at a PNHP national conference in Boston a year or so ago, and some medical student sitting beside me straightened it out for me, medical student, because some medical students are really hot on this subject, which I'm really happy to hear and see. And he said the goal of single payer is not to get everybody across the board equal, which is ridiculous and will never happen, but rather is to raise the floor of care, to assure that everybody has an adequate level of care. And adequate's a big word. I don't mean a capital A adequate. I mean just adequate. That is, no one in his right mind will argue that the care was less than adequate. It is not fantastic. It's not a single bedroom in the hospital. It's not concierge care. It's adequate level of care. And obviously, there's a big, broad way of defining the word adequate in those situations. So that is my vision of a system that we should be working toward. And the word single payer still applies. You go to the doctor when you're sick, and you go, the doctor shows up and gets a paycheck. Private health insurance is going to have to be allowed. It's going to have to be continued. And some of the PNHP people strongly object to that. It's going to have to happen. People who want concierge care and fancy care and their own private, that's good if they can pay for it. However, the cost to those patients should fully pay the expenses of the care the patients receive and the administrative costs incurred by the insurance companies, which is like 30% of the premium. 30%. 30%. That's a big number. And the insurance bill for these people should cover all of those costs without requiring others receiving that care, the insured care, to cover the costs. For example, the way it is now, they have these cost-sharing things, okay, that the U.S. government agrees with something called Medicare Advantage, that the insurance companies and Medicare work together, cover the costs of the care. And again, the insurance companies are taking a very large cut, cover their expenses, very large cut. And when they start having less and less profits, they simply reduce the care. They individual insurance companies simply say, no, we're not going to cover that for you. That is, they're back to being the gatekeeper. And they and their stockholders and the people they have to be held accountable to are cutting the care in order to improve their profits. They also can very rigorously avoid providing care to people who are high risk, which is obviously insurance companies always do this, and provide care for people who are lower risk and charging everybody the same. So that doesn't work. That it's not working well, it's working badly, as a matter of fact. One important point, too. Why is this important? The leading cause for home mortgage forfeitures, for foreclosures, is healthcare.
Right.
Now, this is just a well-known fact. People lose their homes because of healthcare.
Yep.
That's awful. We're the only industrialized country in the world without a single payer system, and we're surely the only industrialized country in the world that lets that happen to people because they're sick. Now, mind you, this only happens to the po folk, okay? It doesn't happen to the people who are wealthy. It doesn't happen to people who have strong health insurance coverage, which either they pay for or, in this case, the labor unions pay for. Somebody else is paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not maybe particularly worried about this subject. Well, I'm worried about it. I'm a bit of a libtard, I think they call us.
No. Oh, no.
Oh,
Lord, help us.
God's state isn't so, really?
You know, there's a church for that, John, I'm sure. They can fix that for you.
Well, I would call him an alpha libtard, is what I would. Because that's me. That's what people call me, the alpha libtard, because I'll scream at people. I don't give a shit.
Yeah. One of the OG.
Anyway. I like being called woke, so yeah.
Yeah, me too. I'm fine with that. Right. By the way, I wanted to just tell John, thank you for having me on again. And Dr. Aldous, it's so good to see you. It really is. It just kind of I'm going through the system right now. Last week I had an appointment. I couldn't get to my GP. He's right down the street, 5 minutes away, which is convenient. They weren't always here, and I couldn't get him, and I couldn't get an appointment with him because he was working at the hospital for 2 weeks, and then he was scheduled for a 2-week vacation. So if I needed to schedule something, I got it on the books in August, and I wrote him a really pretty curt message on my chart saying, dude, what are you doing? Come on, man. I need to see you earlier. This pisses me off, blah, blah, blah. And then they scheduled me to go see somebody who works in association with him in Martinsburg. So it was a PA, really, you know, just doing a great job. I appreciated her. But each thing I did, I went through, I saw a PA, I saw a regular doctor, I went to the ER, I refused the opioids that they prescribed, and probably regretted it. I should explain to Dr. Aldous what happened. I sat on my finger, this finger right here, on my index finger, accidentally while I was on my tractor, and I pulled the index finger out incorrectly, and the entire tip of my finger twisted this way. And twisted. I had to help it twist back again. So now finally, I have an appointment with an orthopedic guy in Spring Mills tomorrow morning. So I'm excited about that. But the medication they had given me, nothing worked. They were like, oh, let's see if it's an infection. We're going to give you doxycycline. Let's see. Oh, wait, no, I have a new, here's a prescription for blah, blah, blah. Well, finally, I went to the ER yesterday and a doctor said, I'm trying to hurry up. I'm sorry, John. I'm running my mouth like, you know, my mom would be saying the same thing. Shut up, Michael. Please, you run your mouth too much. So I got some input from this gentleman who said, you know, I have something that I could prescribe that will probably work called gabapentin. So I went on that. And he also told me, he said, look, you've got to take acetaminophen, you've got to take gabapentin, and you've got to go ahead and think about taking Aleve. So those three pain medications together, that cocktail seemed to work. But I'm going to tell you this really quickly, John, just let me finish, because I told these guys, I played football, I played basketball, I played baseball, ran track, threw the discus, threw the shot put, wrestled, boxed, all this other stuff. As I had concussions, I had a lot of pain. I've had surgeries. Nothing in my life has prepared me for this kind of pain. I'm talking about throbbing pain that wakes you out of a sound sleep where you're screaming into your pillow. And that's, I've missed it. I've told John this, I've had 3 good nights of sleep in the last week and a half. That's it. Last night was one of them. Thank God. But you want to talk about a system that's not beneficial to the end user. It just doesn't seem practical. And I'm not, I'm a very poor person. My wife's on Medicare. I'm on Medicaid. Thank God Medicaid's there, or we would have lost our house.
Right.
So, you know, people have to think about these things. I think about them all the time, like Dr. Aldous does. I want us to go to a single payer system. John and I have been talking about that, but it does. You can't say one size fits all. So I completely agree with your point. So thank you for that. And that's it, John. That's all I have.
Well, you know, you're an example of how much our country is thinking about healthcare. I mean, it's on the agenda everywhere. I mean, you know, it's difficult to not react, especially after the pandemic and got two or three bouts with COVID. And oh my God, it just right.
Yeah, you know, stressed the system, man. Stressed it immeasurably.
And apparently there was quite a bit of corruption in the distribution of additional
money.
Benefits and stuff. I'm not quite sure what the scale of that really was.
Yeah, how does Marjorie Taylor Greene get any of that money?
she's not using it from the English language because she doesn't speak English.
What John Turaldis is speaking to, I think, is there are so many in the private insurance system, there are so many opportunities for corruption being masked as efficiency. You know, and it piles up. And so when the government has to intervene massively, as it did with COVID on a number of fronts, it's very difficult for the money to go where it's supposed to go. Because you got all these people waiting at the trough of any federal money that comes down the stream. Am I right about that, John? I mean,
I've got a guy, I go to the gym 5 days a week here in Shepherd, and there's this one guy who drives a very nice car. He's in good health. He was complaining that he turned 60 recently, and that was me 18 years ago. But he has a disability sticker on his car. Now, I'm talking about corruption in healthcare. Okay, they go to the doctor, they argue with the doctor long enough, and the doctor gives him a lifelong disability sticker. Mm. Now, okay, is that a minor thing? Yeah, that's a minor thing. It's also unprofessional, horribly unprofessional. Now, in a more tightly reviewed single-payer system, that would not be possible. That is, if an individual needs a lifelong stick, he'll get one. This guy does not need one, should not have been given one. And I know how he treated the doctor who resisted giving him one, because they've treated me that way many, many, many times in the past. So now that's a minor thing of corruption, but that's how it's being done. That is, individual doctors can do whatever the hell they want to do.
That's a great example. Thank you, Doc. That's a great example. I mean, it's just one thing, too.
By the way, when we use the word Medicare for all, which is used a lot, the modern phrase of that is improved Medicare for all, because as you know, Medicare does not cover vision, dental, all sorts of stuff, which does need to be covered. Insurance companies, depending on your insurance company, will cover some of this stuff badly, very expensively, but it will. So we should be calling it improved Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, I'm just about the end of my introduction, my talk, actually.
Let me ask another question. Sure. JB, do you have a question? I don't want to silence you.
No, I don't have a question as much as I have a comment.
Well, why don't you go ahead and make a comment then?
I really appreciate John coming on, because we really respect his knowledge and his experience in the industry. But my son is a nurse for the VA, and I'm thinking instead of Medicare for all, it should be VA for all.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting
idea.
The
VA needed a little bit more review of stuff. If you were a veteran, some of these people were veterans like 2 weeks and they were out, but they're still at the VA hospital. And you didn't get enough narcotics, you wrote your congressman. I'm not making that story up. And there wasn't tight enough review in my mind for huge, huge waste of funds.
Right.
And so Medicare isn't that bad yet. But these people, they're called congressionals. They'll write to their congressman, and then the VA spends all this time trying to argue with the congressman about this medical care decision.
The main thing I was talking about was just their system of taking care of the veterans once they come through the front door.
Right. You're sick as a veteran, you go to the hospital and get care. The doctor shows up and takes care of you. He gets a paycheck. Everybody's happy. And seriously, people are happy.
No, I yeah.
Yeah, because it's efficient. It's very efficient.
You know, our friend Larry Bish, JB and Mike, you know, he's a perfect example of that. He's gone through hell, but he is perfectly happy with the care that he's getting at
VA.
He said that several times.
Our last get-together, he said that to me. Yeah, he was very pleased.
You know, so one of the things that, you know, to change the atmosphere a little bit on, for example, in the campaign that Hillary Clinton, I think, led, you know, in the early days of trying to get something going, right? And you had the ended up with Obamacare, ultimately, kind of a version of that. And you're trying to, you know, get something going toward universality without having to, you know, expropriate 3/4 of the wealth of the insurance industry, okay? Which the insurance company is going to tell you is what it's all about. And they're going to use, they campaigned very heavily. I'm sure you guys remember some of the ads they put on TV. With all of their, the public at large, and of course all of the people they covered, and I remember receiving, you know, threats, you know, of horrendous losses and, you know, horrible, you know, health calamities, and then.
Sorry about the threats, John.
You know, and all for, you know, someone else's political agenda, quote unquote, like that, but. You know, to beat that, it might be helpful if the PNHP or similar organizations, you know, a lot of people just don't know, right? They don't, they get a thing in the mail that says, oh, national health care, you won't be, your eyes won't be covered anymore. And of course, whoever is sending out the letter has all the data and knows exactly what the where you might be vulnerable, okay? And so people get it's going to raise a question in their mind, right? If they had a resource, a consulting resource, or a public consult, where, you know, someone that would be arguably fully professional and actually impartial, okay, could say, look, here, can you evaluate my plan compared with some of these claims in this campaign that's going on right now? And, so that, you know, someone could get something that looked like it was independent, but because you can see the confusion. Anytime your health is at stake, at risk, or your children's or your family's, you know, any assertion is going to get it's going to get hot. That's what
John, do you mean that the insurance companies lie sometimes?
You know, I had a conversation with Walt Pelish once about, he used to be an industrial relations corporate expert, but dealing with unions. And I said, we was talking about an old strike that happened. And I said, you lied. And he said, of course we lied. Fool. And he says, that's okay. I wasn't fooled. I knew you were lying. Okay. But anyway, I mean, it's just a tactic, lying. Okay. Who gives a
oh
shit?
You know, so. Yeah. I mean, it's John and I did, John and I talk about this a lot. I think sometimes we have to change the definition of corporation. You know, because it's not just the healthcare system; it's the entire capitalistic. I'm not a capitalist. Okay, I want people to make money, and that's probably a good thing. They should get paid for, but. There has to be, as Elizabeth's Professor Warren has said, there has to be a cop on the beat. We have to have somebody looking out for the American citizens and people, you know, as a whole. It can't just be, oh, well, you know, our profit margin's looking pretty good. You know, just everybody smile and move along. You know, it's all about what Dr. Aldous said at the beginning of this is it's about money. It's about making their shareholders richer.
So,
and also working cooperatively within the medical industrial complex. I still love that.
Right.
So we come back to the question of taxes.
Yeah.
Now, we had this conversation. I had this conversation with Joe Manchin. And I will say this about Joe Manchin. I know everyone, you know, all this, but he does not usually lie to you. I'm sure he's done so in the past, but he doesn't. So I had this conversation with about healthcare, and he said to me, "So how much is it going to be in taxes? Okay, to pay for this system?" He says, and I said, "Well, in Canada, it's probably around 40%. You know, the tax rates for people in general. Okay, and it's covering that thing." He says, 40% taxes. I don't want to pay it." And you know, that was his answer, right? But when you take it to Western Virginia,
he has enough money to take care of his own needs.
Well, I understand that, but hold on. But he's playing a card that plays right now very well in West Virginia, because if you talk about any benefit that's going to require an increase in the existing West Virginia tax rates, that burden is going to be borne by people who can't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, and that's when you play that card in this state, you get ordinarily well intentioned people to start to get their back up, you know, about the whole thing. And especially in rural areas where, you know, the property tax pays, that there isn't much other revenue to pay for a number of things. Okay. The income tax in West Virginia, you know, I mean, it's a small fraction of the wealth available. I mean, most of the wealth is being shipped out in the form of coal and natural gas, okay? And that, whoever's making the money on that, they don't live in the state except for our governor. I see a problem with the tax. Getting a national benefit as expensive as national health care would be, okay? At least not the scale that it would have to be implemented. You know, you got to address the tax question and equity. Who's going to be taxed, and how's that going to work?
One question, John, is instead of seeing how much the taxes will increase, see how much money people are currently paying for health insurance.
Right. Sorry.
And call that taxes. Just yep. for the argument, yes. call that tax.
Okay.
All of a sudden, the number is very different.
Cover. Yep.
That's a very important calculation to publicize. That's key right there. Okay, because that, you know, once you get to credibly before the public, look, you're not going to be paying more. You're going to be paying less, especially the working class and middle class people. You know that have been, let's just phrase it, squeezed by the inflation and combat last 40 years pretty badly. Okay, so.
And the affluent people can continue their health insurance.
Sure, that's right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Because Joe Manchin doesn't lie. Joe Manchin doesn't lie. Can maybe not. He's ill-informed.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm having a chat. It was fairly public. It was in a very crowded space. And we were talking about treatment for addiction, and I mentioned Suboxone and methadone, which are the two major drugs used for opiate addiction. Oh no, methadone's no good. Now this is a drug which was went through clinical trials in the 1950s, has been used since then. Many of the people in the clinical trials are still on methadone. They're doing very well. They're not dead yet.
Right, that's okay. Right.
It's an effective drug needed in many cases. People on Suboxone have to be moved to methadone for clinical medical reasons for which Joe Manchin has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. But his official policy as a senator is this drug is no good and it's dangerous.
Oh, for God's sakes.
Now, you know, this is part of the problem we're dealing with when we try to deal with healthcare, and we have people like him and a lot of others deciding what is good medical care and what isn't. I won't even go on to abortions and reproductive health. But there are medical things that really are important, and these people are really messing things up, Joe Manchin included.
Yes.
That part of it, I agree. I totally agree.
If the public doesn't take over the energy industry in some form in West Virginia, there's no hope. I'm serious.
No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to. It's a morbid laugh, John. You know, it's just going through this whole thing. Just it continues to inform. It continues to inform me what's going on. And I'm not one to go through something and then not discuss it and say, hey, John, what do you think of this?
I think we have to do a Norway on our natural resources.
I agree, set up a sovereign wealth fund. That's a great idea, John.
Then you can do something. But you got to overthrow the energy autocracy.
Yeah.
To do it. I mean, at least as far as the government goes. I mean, you're still going to have to sell out leases to all this resources. Okay, you're still going to have to do that. If you don't do it, you don't have any money. Okay, so that's the source of money. But the energy projects, great. But the public has to get the funds to reinvest in its welfare. You know, right. So for example, the education standards go up, the health care standards go up. You know, otherwise, who's going to come over the hill to save us? I think Senator Byrd is dead. Okay, I mean,
yeah.
We're not going to get a chairman of the Appropriations Committee again in our lifetime. Okay, so
yeah, well, as also too is like what we could do, John. Honestly, is to have Representative Green send the gazpacho police to.
There's not enough green peppers.
She was trying to say Gestapo, and she said gazpacho.
Yeah, I know, right? That's okay.
So, two more points. One of the things John very appropriately asked, "What can we do now?" But here's all the reasons why you can't do it, which is usually the discussion that almost anything being proposed costs too much money, can't be done now. There are too many Republicans, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things we could do is move toward lowering the age of Medicare, bringing Medicare down to a lower age. That is, somehow, before we get Medicare for all, before we get a single system, we're going to have to shift or drift into better ideas. And one of them would be to lower the age of acceptable access to Medicare.
What would be the age you'd want, Dr. John?
Zero. Birth, at birth. Get a Medicare card at birth.
Outstanding. I love it.
We'll go down a year per year, okay?
And yeah. That would be so 70 years from now. No. And also, when Obama was still, before he was running for president, while he was still a senator, I guess he was, and still talking rationally about this, he actually mentioned the word, because I heard an interview that he actually said these words, single-payer system. He actually said that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as he started running for president, the words never came out of his mouth again.
Right.
I don't think anybody saying those words, me included, all of us here included, I don't think us saying those words are going to drag us into some massively expensive hell that we'll all be. No, just saying, look, health care is a human right.
Yeah.
Looking at it any other way is doing a lot of damage.
Yes,
now, that is not going to raise taxes, saying the words healthcare is a human. That's not going to raise taxes. It's not going to raise taxes saying a single-payer system is going to. That's not going to raise taxes either. Okay? That's not going to do damage to say these obvious points. It also meshes us with all the other industrialized countries in the world. We're the only country in the world who refuses to say that. So, there you are. I'm finished.
That's a great point. I got to jump. I got to go. But John,
yeah, we're at
and Dr.
Good time.
John and JB, I can't tell you how much this meant to me this morning. I really do. John, thank you so much for having me.
All right,
guys.
Mike.
I miss you guys. I'm going to try to come back every once in a while, but I got to take care of this. I got to go take care of some business with this finger. And hopefully I'll keep the finger and I'll be able to exercise the middle finger, which is the most important one.
I hope so too, buddy.
Okay, guys. Bye.
Take care, man.
Good luck, man.
By the way, John, I like your the year by year. I think somebody proposed that in there was a. I think Bernie did. Bernie do that, or it was somebody else. It might have been somebody.
Reducing the age of Medicare is talked about a lot.
But you still run into the solid block there. I think you're stuck with, in a way, this issue is entangled like a number of others with you got a political crisis in the country. I mean, there's no no way to hide that. Okay. I mean, what did Trump yesterday called out for, you know, more executive authority, more dictatorial authority for the president if he wins, quote unquote.
Ridiculous.
Well, I think, you know, I think you have to say it's serious.
Yeah, you got to take it serious until, I mean, he's got to be locked up. He should have been locked up last year.
Yeah, but he hasn't been. And they're going to have a hard time.
My greatest fears are he wins or he loses.
I think he's going to lose, but
But look what he did the last time he lost.
Right. He didn't lose, right. Well, yeah.
It could be a horror story either way.
It could be. Depends on how much support he builds up. But that all depends a little bit on, you know, Biden is... I mean, you got a lot of showdowns going on, for example, in national labor this season, all through the fall. Big ones. There's some going on right now.
Teamsters.
UPS. I mean, and I want to tell you, those guys got a 97% strike vote out of 330,000 people. That's pretty potent, okay? And and I think you're going to get the same thing out of auto. About over, you know, recovering lost money through the pandemic. You know, those part-time UPS drivers, they haven't had a raise in 5 years.
That's right.
You know, and they're riding around sitting on the top of engines with no air conditioning in buses driving through South Texas. <It's> just, that's hot. So, yeah, I think it's going to be entangled with the national political crisis, seems to me, and it's hard to get a handle on how to, you know, it almost seems like it's out of control, like you have forces, interests that are just diverging. Okay, maybe it's because of the increased pressure of the weather. Or just this aggravated inequality that's been around for half a century almost now, or whatever. I don't, you know, or the global situation, it just becomes more and more, never reaches stability, you know. There could be a lot of reasons, but still.
A lot of people are looking back at a time in the past when one job took care of a family and kids and car, mm-hmm. one job sent your kids to college, to school, and there were labor unions.
Yeah, 50s and 60s.
Maybe there's a connection between the two.
Sure.
Yeah, I think there's got to be one. But again, you know, it's not one of those problems that labor is going to solve at a bargaining table, okay? You know, the company's not going to put its management rights on the table for negotiation. At least I've never seen it happen. You know, and, you know, but it's got to be political. And so you got two parties, and both are very heavily influenced by billionaires. Different. I mean, Jeff Bezos hates Trump. He does. Okay. But he don't love me. Okay. He just doesn't. He doesn't. Okay. And, you got Bill Gates, right? Now he's pissed off at Biden because the FCC stood against him trying to buy Activision, and he won in court with a Trump appointed judge. Okay,
no
so you know, where are these guys? And these guys are spending a lot of money in politics now. So I listened to Jamie Dimon yesterday again. You know, doing he's getting in the press every other day now. I assume that means he's searching for a cabinet position. Probably, if Treasury Secretary Yellen's not going to do a second term, he'll probably put in a plea for the job.
And, but John, Supreme Court judges are expensive. Come on.
They are expensive, and how do you get rid of them? You can't get rid of them except through impeachment.
Yeah, that's right.
And you got to end conviction. So, I mean, you don't have a court above them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing exception I know in history is Abraham Lincoln, you know, said, well, you can render your judgment after the war is over as to what I'm going to do with your Maryland militia that's trying to participate in overthrowing the government. I'm going to detain them, and I'm not going to take them to trial either. So, that was an example of, and it was interesting, you know, after the war, Congress had, the court ruled that it was unconstitutional, but Congress passed its own sort of retroactive agreement that the holding the Maryland militia without habeas corpus was okay, because it was an invasion or a rebellion, which is what the constitutional statute actually says. Anyway, so you can get around it, but is Biden going to defy the Supreme Court on? We got abortion, you got affirmative action, you got,
they got the pipeline today.
What's that? What's going on that? Is that a?
They filed an emergency decision with the Supreme Court, MVP.
MV Mountain View. They want to be able to go ahead, right? Is that what they're doing
right
they now?
Yeah, the Supreme Court to overrule the lower.
Well, they're
courts.
Probably going
to
get it.
You know, the system's rigged for sure.
Oh, I mean, they made up their mind. So, I mean, I don't know. And what can you do about it? And
it's a disaster. It should never have happened. It shouldn't have gotten as far as it did.
I don't know when. I can't remember when we could have fixed it. I mean, I feel bad, JB, because I feel I'm leaving my children, you know, with this. The mess is worse as bad as what I decided it was a mess 50 years ago, 60. And
methane is worse than coal. The methane pollution is worse than what the coal plants emit.
That's right.
And that's the bottom line. You know, if we're going to get serious about climate, we've got to stop these projects.
Well, you can't shut it. You're going to have to do something, because if you shut it down, the state will be evacuated. There's nothing else. There's no other money. I mean, you're like Norway. Think of yourself. You're like Norway. You can't. You're stuck. I mean, you can find a way to. You won't be able to do anything about it if you can't take control of it from coal companies and natural gas companies.
Right.
That's, you got to be able to have the state has to be able to say, oh, okay, we're gonna issue leases and stuff like that for whatever needs to be done, but we own it. And you know, I think the Constitution of West Virginia does say that actually, in some place.
Well, Biden's second term will be like FDR. You know, he's gonna nationalize the resources and nationalize medicine. And, you know, things are going to get a lot better. They have to. Otherwise, we're going to fail. The whole thing's going down.
He's no FDR.
He's no FDR. I don't think he is.
No, but I mean, he won't have to run for reelection. So he can do what he wants. I'm just saying, if we can win the Congress back, we have to win the Congress back.
Yeah, that's right.
So we have all three, and then we can get rid of those corrupt Supreme Court judges.
That's true, if you win the Congress back. But how is that going to happen right now in West Virginia?
It's not, nothing's going to happen here politically.
Well, I mean, the breakthrough, maybe Michigan, Minneapolis, so Michigan, Minnesota, they're doing some interesting stuff. Illinois, the governor is a good guy. So there has been a move, you know. Anyway, we probably ought to terminate this for today.
Well, don't put it that way. We need to end the show, John.
We need to end